The Bain Free Radio Hour.
Hello and welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour. Today, Sean Hazlett interviews Larry Correa on Heart of the Mountain, the stunning conclusion to the saga of the Forgotten Warrior. In addition, we continue with the last chapter of Wen Spencer's Tinker, Part 86.
Welcome to the Bain Free Radio Hour podcast. I'm here with Larry Correa, and we're here to talk the Heart of the Mountain. How you doing, my friend?
I am doing good. I'm having a good time.
We were
actually, my eyes are all red because we were laughing our butts off right before we started recording. But that's besides the point. We were telling stories.
Yeah. Lots of interesting uses of taxpayer dollars. And we'll just leave it at that. So this is the sixth book in the series now?
That's correct. Yes, sixth and final.
Okay, so if you can kind of orient the audience, for people who just fell off a turnip truck and are new to the series, high level, what's it about, and what's the kind of the high level pitch?
Okay, so the series starts with a book called Son of the Black Sword, and it is my epic fantasy series. It is the main character wants you to think of basically an Indian version of like a fantasy world Judge Dredd. So he's a roving magical law enforcement officer who enforces the law in a land where law is this all-consuming thing that's basically replaced religion. Religion is illegal. And he is a guy who goes out and does horrible things on behalf of the law. Society has really rigid caste systems. It's a world of magic, and it's a world where everybody has a place, except he discovers that all isn't what it seems, and he's not really who he thinks he is. And he's such an honor-bound individual, and stuff kind of spirals off from there, and it goes from Judge Dredd to George Washington. And over the course of six books, it's a fantastic series. I'm really, really proud of it. Came out super good. I've been working on this for 10 years and nailed the landing with Heart of the Mountain. And the reviews are coming in, and I killed it. And a lot of people are saying this is one of the best fantasy series that they've ever read. And from beginning to end, we just had a lot of fun with it. And so the book ends. We build up to this big climatic thing that we've been talking about for six books. Because in this world, the sea is actually hell. But they're on one continent surrounded by an ocean that's infested with demons. And, demons don't trespass on land, and man doesn't trespass on the water. Well, until now. And so this is the big final throwdown, and it is awesome. So I hope people like it. Check it out. So Son of the Black Sword is the first one. Heart of the Mountain is the finale. Yeah, and I'm really proud of it. I'm really super pleased with how this came out.
Yeah, it starts, at least this particular book, it starts and kind of after, let's just say, a big event. If you could kind of, without giving too much away, where are we in the series when this book starts?
Over the previous five books, I established that the law is out of the place called the Capitol, which is the central city. It's basically like Las Vegas out in the desert. It's a metropolis in a place that it shouldn't exist. But the reason it's there is because that's the farthest you can get from the ocean. And these people consider the ocean unclean. Only the demons have found a way to circumvent that. I'll leave it at that. And so we're picking up right after that. So basically mankind is kind of on the ropes. And they're throwing down against the invaders. Ashok Vidal is the main character I've been talking about. I'm on my Judge Dredd, George Washington. And he's kind of put together a coalition of people who were the outsiders before. They were the casteless. They were the criminals. They were the religious fanatics. They were the people who had no place. And he's put together an army, basically. And he offers their services in exchange for having a place and not being part of the caste system anymore, not being criminal outsiders put to death on sight. And so they basically try to ride to the rescue against an insurmountable horde of demons that are invading the world. And it's just pretty wicked, actually. I've got a ton of characters in this, epic fantasy series. You've got a huge cast of characters. And one of the things I was able to do here is I was able to provide a good, satisfying conclusion to everybody. I mean, not everyone lives. A lot of people die. This is a big showdown. A lot of people die, but everything has a purpose. And by golly, if I kill somebody, I make it worth it. I just don't kill anybody just to be a nihilist.
Well, the one thing I like about what you do with this, particular novel, and I mean also just in the throughout the series, is the way that news travels and and kind of dealing with trying to get people who are on the verge of like annihilating another another nation that there's like no wait, we gotta keep them, we gotta keep them, and just like convincing people that like. This cataclysm has happened, and no, it's not another trick. And it's almost like us now, like trying to figure out what's the truth and what are lies in this sort of medium where things are constantly evolving. If you talk a little bit about that,
Yeah,
and
I had a lot of.
to me, it feels like it's reflective of kind of the time we're living in, but I don't know if that was intentional.
Yeah, well, actually, kind of. So I have this all-powerful central government, and it's over a group of like confederation of like houses is what they are, and they're basically noble families rule their lands, but they all answer to the central law, which is the highest caste as the lawgivers, the people who administer it. The bureaucrat caste basically has replaced the priest caste. But yeah, so there's a lot of manipulation. There's a lot of politics in this. I mean, it's not a political book as much as it's an action book, but there's a lot of politics and a
Right.
lot of politicking. And I had a lot of fun with that because one of the bad guys is like a master of manipulating information and manipulating emotion. And throughout the book, you will see him take things and twist them and then put it out there to get the result that he wants. At one point, he sees graffiti on the walls of the Capitol, which is just unheard of, right? Because people are under arrest. And he starts looking at the graffiti and he's like, wow, that's actually a really good idea. So he commissions his inquisitors to go out and secretly make graffiti. He's like, find me some men who were hoodlums in their youth. And then he have his graffiti out there. He put on plays. During the course of this book, he had a narrative he wanted to establish about like Ashok Vidal is this psychopathic barbarian murderer trying to overthrow the law. So he takes real events and they made a play about it. And it was like the toast of the Capitol, and thousands of people went to see it and they went home scared to death of Ashok Vidal. But one of the things we think about fantasy world, you got we this before phones and radios and whatnot. And so communication travels slow. And that's one of the things I try to keep in mind is the geography and how long it would take for news to get from place to place to place. And that becomes part of the plot because one of the things that occurs in this book is basically a genocide is ordered against the Castless, which then they have to call off partway through. It's like, hey, it's like the Battle of New Orleans. It's like, oh, hey, the war's over. So I try to keep that in mind because a lot of people when they write fantasy they think of the news travels really quickly and it didn't.
Right. Unless you have magic, which, you
And
sometimes
I
you
do
get.
actually have magical communication in this,
Right.
but I made it really expensive, and so basically the only people who use it are the high elite connected people, and so they could coordinate, but then everybody else was just kind of in the dark. Kind of blundering around. And so that wasn't a major part of the book or anything, but it's just kind of like a little world building feature there that you can communicate quickly, but you're going to pay for it. Because in this series, magic is a f there's a couple sources of magic, but they're finite. One is replaceable, but it's extremely hard to get and very dangerous to get, and that's demons. Like you can harvest demon bodies and harvest the
Until
magic from them.
recently in certain places.
Yeah, up until book five, when suddenly the market has a glut. But then there's the black steel, which is super powerful, really pure magic, but it is irreplaceable. There's only so much in the world. There's no more new. It's what's there is there. So it's kind of hoarded, and only extremely powerful people have it. So. Yeah, that's it's funny. I wrote a book. I wrote a fantasy book, and it never gets to this. But I built the economy of this fantasy world. And none of this is in the book. Like a lot of the stuff, it's part of the world and it makes sense, in context. But I have fractional reserve banking in a fantasy world. That never comes up in the book, except for when you get the politics between the houses. That's why it works the way it does, is the first cast has a central bank, for trade purposes. So I did a ton of world building in this, but just you guys know who haven't read it, it is a action adventure, sword and sorcery kind of book. It's not an economics textbook or anything like that. I love that stuff, but I'm not gonna like beat you over the head with it.
Yeah, there's another author like way back when who did some of that. It was like Raymond Feist, I think. And he had like Ford contracts and like people would be making money on grain futures and just like ran. I said a lot of words, so people are like, "What the hell is this guy talking about?"
Stuff
Larry
is
knows what I'm
actually,
talking about.
it's funny when you're doing a fantasy novel, just because we think of it in the world building as the writer and we want to have it really cool, doesn't necessarily mean it belongs in the book, because that might be boring as hell,
Right.
So there's a lot of stuff that's like, this is how the world works. So as long as we stay consistent with how the world works, and all that stuff is there behind the scenes for us, I mean, we could reference it, makes perfect sense. Just don't info dump it. And bore the crap out, because I love economics. I find economics fascinating. Doesn't mean my readers are. So no, it's not. No, don't worry. I don't get into fractional reserve banking. We just have more sword fights.
All right, in terms of some of the characters here, if you could kind of discuss some of them and what you consider their arcs to be throughout the story, and or not story, but like throughout the series, and what they have to resolve in this final installment.
Okay, so the main character is Ashok Vidal, and he's the guy that goes from protector of the law to the greatest criminal in the world, through no fault of his own. So his arc really is learning to become a human being. I mean, he becomes a great leader of men, but really he's learned to be human, because before that he's kind of I don't want to give too much away. He's a construct of the law. He's been built from the ground up to be the perfect warrior. On behalf of the law, only he kind of gets stolen by the illegal gods to be their champion. But Ashok has to learn to be a person. And that's his main arc, and he does. And not always a good one, but he does. Then the love interest in this is a woman named Theravane. Now Thera is the prophet of this religion, unwittingly and unwillingly. She gets shoved into this role. And she's kind of a rebel. By personality, she's a rebel. She's a troublemaker. She's a nonconformist in a place where everybody conforms. She's a child of the warrior caste. She has to wind up becoming like kind of the mother figure of this movement of rejects and outcasts and casteless and criminals and religious fanatics. And that's kind of her arc, is stepping into that role. And I have a whole bunch of other characters that I love. The really popular ones is Jagdish. Jagdish is the warrior. He's the consummate warrior. He is the king. He is the ideal of his caste, because he's just an honorable dude. He's a soldier. There's no airs. There's no pretension. He's just a soldier trying to do the right thing. And he goes from the first book, we first meet him, he's this low-ranking guy who basically got put on an honor guard, who just gets shafted by fate over and over again. And but so we get the perspective of the warrior caste through Jagdish, and by the time we get to the end of the book, this is a man who's been drug along by fate. Who He's not a religious man, because he's a law-abiding man, but fate to him is a god, and she's a fickle, angry, cruel god, and because she's a soldier. I have another character, major character, is Devadas. He's the man who would be king. He's Ashok's brother, from when they were growing up as protectors. Also a servant of the law, very powerful man, very driven, extremely ambitious, extremely intelligent, one of the best warriors in the world. But his flaw is his ambition, because he was a man who should have had everything and it was taken from him. And because of that, he's bitter. And he's the guy behind the scenes trying to overthrow the law to install himself as king. He's basically trying to become a dictator. And he's a good guy and a bad guy. Simultaneously, just depending on where you're sitting at the time. If you're his enemy, he's the bad guy. If you're his ally, he's the good guy. And he's a complex dude. One of my favorite characters to write. And he achieves his goals, but not in the way that he wanted. So, I mean, it's a huge cast of characters. I mean, there's dozens of characters. There's probably probably like four or five like secondary characters we really get into. I make sure everybody gets their comeuppance at the end or their reward. That's one nice thing about epic fantasies. You can just have this huge cast, but the main thing is you got to like focus on the stuff people care about and give the fans what they want and give them those conclusions. And so there's even like secondary and tertiary characters that the fans just loved. And it's like, by golly, they're going to see their heroic end or their happy ever after, you know? And so that was one nice thing about being able to finish up this book and having room to work and making a 6-book series instead of a 5-book series is I was able to get all that stuff in. And
when you first
pitched
it, how many books was it supposed to be?
Okay, so I pitched Son of the Black Sword to Tony Weisskopf at Bayon as a 3-book trilogy. And I gave her the outline. She looked at that outline and she said, I'll give you a deal for 3 books for now, but she's like, you're not going to fit this in 3 books. She's like, this is 5 books. Because I had the end from the very beginning. I'm an outliner. Mm-hmm. So I was like, I think it'll be 3. And so I started writing the second book and turned into book 2 and book 3. And so she was right. And at that point, it was a 5-book series. And then I started writing Graveyard of Demons, which was the last book, the 5th book, mm-hmm. Which came out last year. The problem was all the other, I write, my epic fantasies tend to be about 140, 150,000 words. I don't write 300,000 word Brandon Sanderson size doorstoppers. I write more thriller pace, right? Mm-hmm. So I was in the series. All the other books are 140, 150,000 words. I get to Graveyard of Demons. I'm at 220,000 words and I haven't written the finale yet. So at that point I contacted Tony and I was like, book 5 is getting really, really big. I think I need to break it into 2, which so we did. And so we broke Graveyard of Demons into 2. Heart of the Mountain, actually, the name was suggested by Jason Cordova. If you've read the series, you know Heart of the Mountain is like a big deal in the series. It actually is a perfect mm-hmm. title. And so I had a big climactic fight, which we're talking about the Capitol a minute ago. That was part way through book 5, and that just became the end of book 5. And that actually worked really well. And that gave me book 6 to like have room to play. I had to break it to the fans that no, the series isn't done yet. But they were happy. They got one more book out of it. And it actually worked really well. And like I said, the reviews on it are spectacular. So I think my gamble on that one paid off.
All right. I would ask you a loaded question, but I promise you it is a fun loaded question. From start to finish, how long did it take you to write the series?
Oh, 10 years, about, almost, yeah.
So for those out there who are still struggling to complete their longstanding series, do you have any advice to those authors, Larry?
Okay. So right now, starting an epic fantasy series is really, really hard because certain authors have kind of burned the market. And so a lot of fantasy readers don't want to start a series until it's done. And the problem is, it takes a lot of years to write a good epic fantasy series, and it's hard to do that without getting any money for the first book. So what I would recommend is if you're going to write a fantasy right now, make sure you write book 1 in a way that it has a satisfying arc on its own that can stand alone. So that would be my first piece of advice. Make sure you write that first book that this is by itself a, you know, not left open-hanging thing. Now, once you have a solid fan base that'll follow you from book to book, then you're good to go. You can do it. And that's indie or traditional. If you have a solid fan base that'll follow you from book to book, you're good to go. Until you get that, though, make sure that stands on its own. And then it's open to a series should the first one do well. Because otherwise, yeah, there's a pretty critical chunk of the market that just kind of got burned. And beyond that, I would say stick to it. Have a vision. I know discovery writing is fun. I just discovery wrote a book a little while ago. But I think for an epic fantasy with a big giant story arc and like a giant cast of characters, outlining really is your friend, because otherwise you're going to write yourself into a corner and get stuck. I wrote a little action fantasy novel, and I pantsed it, and it was great. It came out great, but the cast is only like, you know, maybe like three or four main characters. That's it. This, you know, I've got three or four main characters and 25 secondary characters and 150 tertiary characters and 12 great houses and 2,000 years of history and culture and, you know, political plots and machinations and all this Machiavellian stuff going on and sea monsters. I mean, so to do that over six books, yeah, I think requires some forethought. I would definitely say if you're planning on doing an epic fantasy series, make sure you got your ducks in a row on that one. So
that raises a great question. So when you write six of these novels, how do you keep all the facts straight? So there's not some autist out there is like, well, actually in book four,
I'm still going to run into that guy, 'cause I'm only human. I will screw up. I keep a Word document open as I write, which is a series notes. Basically it's like a world Bible. So, and I don't usually update it as I write. I'll update it as I edit. So I'll go through and I'll be like, okay, these are the following new characters I introduced. And so I have like an alphabetical list of character names and a little brief thing about who they are, so I remember. If I give out factoids about a character that might come up again, like he's right-handed or whatever, you know, he's got a scar on his left eye, whatever, I'll put that in there. But then I'll have stuff like location data. Like if I have mentioned towns within the boundaries of a great house, I will throw. If I said that this place is southwest of this place, I will put that down. That's to keep me from tripping over it later on. All my little world building stuff, I was talking about like how the banking system works and that kind of thing, how the currency system worked. That's in my notes, not necessarily in the book, just for me to keep track of stuff. How certain magic things work. Like if I describe how a certain magic thing works, I will note that in the series Bible too. That way I don't contradict myself later on in how I'm describing it. I would recommend doing that, especially for characters, just to keep your facts straight. Like if somebody says they know somebody else and later on you have them not know each other, like you said, the autistic reader is going to be like, what the crap? You freaking idiot. What's wrong with you? And and I still screw that up. Writers, we're going to screw stuff up. I guarantee it. And I made this mistake more with Monster Hunter in the early books, because that's an 8-book series so far, and I got more of those coming, and a bunch of spin-offs and short stories and whatnot. That's one so big worldwide that, yes, I have contradicted myself. And so when people...
Well, you also have other authors writing in the...
And so I try to catch them, too, but I miss sometimes. I'll miss stuff that they put in. And so that's one that, yeah, you do the best you can. And when that guy finds the error, just be like, unreliable narrator. Really unreliable author, because I'm only human.
Yeah, you got me. You got me, right?
Yeah. So I've dropped the ball on a few things over the years. But you just try to keep it as tight as you can. So have a world Bible, I think, is very important. Later on then, too, when you turn it into a role-playing game, That world Bible is going to be really super useful for you.
Do you build like a map, or do you just verbally record where the
I just record. Now I do have a map for this one, but it's just a map of the continent. I don't have like a detailed map. It's just like, here's a handful of locations that are referenced. It's mostly the main cities. If I was to do a updated map now, it would be basically the same thing, only with more locations that we've gone to since. But didn't do it. Maps are actually pricey. It turns out having a good quality map. And my first map was done by Isaac Stewart. It's beautiful. I have actually, you can't see it, but it's on my wall. I have the original giant framed map of Locke on my wall in here. And I love having a map, honestly, for a fantasy world. That's half the fun, you know?
100% just coming up with.
I thoroughly enjoy that.
What about the history? Like, did you, it said you had thousands of years of history. How long did you spend developing that before you started?
Quite a bit, because I on this one, I had the idea for one scene before anything else. And I wrote this one scene first, and then I started world building around what I would need to have to make that kind of world work. if that makes sense. And my world building process, and I've talked about this on the Writer Dojo a lot, is asking yourself, if this, then what? If this is here, why? If they do this, why do they do that? If this thing is here, they've put this thing into place, why did they do that? Everything has a reason. And what happens is if you start asking those questions, it will slowly spiral outward from your original question. So you'll come up with one thing in world building. Like, I want this one thing. And originally for me, it was like, caste systems. Why do they have the rigid caste systems the way they do? And so I started looking at the history of like why we would have that. It's also one reason I wound up with a kind of Indian setting as opposed to a like European setting, was because I wanted to be able to draw on real history of a place that did have something like that. So mine's different, obviously, but some of the fundamental issues that arise off that, I could look at history and borrow from history to see, and culture, and to see how do people react to these kind of things? How do people learn from these kind of things? And so I started asking about, like, why does this exist? Well, you needed something like this in the past. There needs to be a reason for this one group to be so ostracized. What would that reason be? Mm-hmm. And then I like looking at fantasy tropes, and whenever, because tropes exist for a reason. A lot of people like to make fun of tropes, but tropes exist in storytelling because they're storytelling shorthand. They become popular because they resonate with audiences. Mm-hmm. So one of the things I like to do is I like to look at those tropes and I assess, say, which ones of these are useful to me and which ones are not. And the ones that are not, I'm going to flip them upside down. I'm gonna have some fun with them. And then this, one of the fantasy tropes and part of the world building was, you ever have this thing in fantasy where there's a chosen one, right? There's a guy who's supposed to like right the wrongs and fix the problem, defeat the big evil bad guy. And there's always like, he's a descendant. He's from the bloodline of the great hero who beat the bad guy 1,000 years ago or 400 years ago, whatever it is. You've seen that hundreds and hundreds of times in fantasy, right? Since the beginning of storytelling, that's been a common thing. The descendant, so here's King Arthur and his descendants going to do whatever, you know? Okay, common trope. And so whenever we have these fantasy stories, that descendant, there's just one guy in the fantasy stories. The chosen one is one dude who's descended from the great hero who's going to fix the wrongs and defeat Saruman this time. Okay, the problem is that's not how genetics works. That's not how human DNA works. You don't have one descendant in 1,000 years. You have 18,000 descendants or 50,000 descendants, or if you're Genghis Khan, you know, 20 million, so, or whatever it may be. So I flipped that on the head. So I had this great hero in the past, Ram Rowan, who defeated the demons, cast him in the sea. It was prophesized that they were going to like come again at some time in the future. And only the blood, this is very specific, only the bloodline of Ram Rowan could defeat them. Only descended Ram Rowan would be able to defeat them. And I show why in the books in this last one. But in real life, that 1,000 years, that guy wouldn't have one character. He wouldn't have one descendant. He'd have 1,000 descendants. Because if you knew the survival of your people, the survival of your society and your species dependent upon one bloodline, they're going to turn into the House of Sod. They're not going to have one kid. They're not going to have three kids. They're going to have 18 kids each for 20 generations, you know, and many, many wives and concubines. And you're going to make sure that that bloodline never runs out. So what happens? I had the bloodline of Ramaron. And as time went on, they grew and they basically became the House of Saud. They ruled everything and all the castes were formed to cater to them and to give them what they wanted and to serve them at all times. The warriors were to protect them. The priests were to preach their religion. But over time, they become, anytime you have a group of people like that, they're going to become tyrannical. They're going to become bossy right. and pushy. Hey, the world depends on me. You got to cater to me. I'm taking all your gold and your women, right? I mean, we've seen this every time. It's just human nature. So what happens is over time, people forget about the demons. Now the demons are a distant threat. The bloodline of Ramaron is the current threat. They're the tyrannical government. So they get overthrown. But enough people recall the old ways and say, they're supposed to be necessary. They might be necessary in the future. We can't just kill them all. So let's keep them around, but let's never, ever, ever let them have power ever again. So they already had a caste system built. So they took the highest caste, defeated them, and then put them way down here in the garbage. Mm-hmm. And they had rules saying you can't kill them, but you can never do anything nice for them. And that just became the culture. And over time, people forgot why that was. You know, in another 1,000 years, that's why is that even a thing? It just is. And now we pick up, and people are like, why don't we just get rid of these scum?
Right.
And yeah, so that's where it's at. And yeah, so I love world building. I love asking questions as to why does this do that, and it leads to all sorts of really cool things. I just come up with, like, I want to do this cool thing, and then everything else is just justification of how I can logically do this cool thing.
So here's a chicken and egg question. Which came first, the city in the middle of the desert, or the where would I build a city in order to be as far from these things as possible?
Yeah, so originally it was so I had, if the ocean is hell and everything in the culture is about the ocean is unclean, I mean, fish eater is an insult for the castless. And so if you have your priest caste, I'm sorry, now bureaucrat caste that runs everything, they're going to want to be as far away from the ocean as possible for prestige. But then I was actually building the map of it. And one of the things I like is the city of Las Vegas makes me laugh, right? Because Las Vegas shouldn't exist. It is an anomaly. Las Vegas, there's no logical reason for Las Vegas to be a metropolis. It exists because of legalized gambling in a place that should not support a population like that at all. And so Las Vegas has always struck me as this funny anomaly of a place. It exists because of a political reason, not because of a logical reason. And so I was like, okay, so what I'm going to do then is I'm going to build the continent in such a way so the place far away from the ocean is a super inhospitable desert, where it doesn't make any sense to live there, except it makes political sense to live there, because now you're pure, you're far from the ocean, you're better than everyone else. You know, they don't have holiness, but they still have holiness. You know, since they've replaced religion with government, their government is clean. It's above. It's high above the ocean. It's 1,000 miles from the sea. It's also in this inhospitable central desert. And within a mountain range, that basically I describe as kind of, if you've ever been to Nevada, it's very much that,
High
Intermountain,
desert.
high desert area there, not Intermountain, but like the West Desert area. I graduated high school in Delta, Utah. Okay, so if anybody's ever been to Delta, Utah, you know exactly what the land around the Capitol looks like, up to and including the volcanic mountain right next door. So yeah, it's an inhospitable place, but it's far from the ocean, and that makes them better than everybody else. So they have to build the over time as it grows, they have to build these massive aqueducts to funnel water, which once again, for the world building purposes, that enabled me to have some tactical and strategic fun later on. Because if the most important people in the world are dependent upon aqueducts, and you're a rebellion, you're going to target the aqueducts. And yeah, no, so I had quite a bit of fun with that, with the world building. So that was a chicken and an egg, but I would say the first thing that came was the self-righteous government class. Then I stuck them in a desert because Las Vegas makes me laugh.
It's not quite a swamp, but
Yeah,
the
it's
echoes are there.
places that really shouldn't exist.
Kind of artificial places that aren't states, but.
Yeah, it's funny because there's two kinds of, they're basically like, honestly, in the history of the world, there's a few kinds of cities. There are cities that exist because they're in a location that makes sense for, like, resources, like the
Yeah,
mouths of
long
rivers,
rivers.
that kind of thing. Yeah, mountain passes, like agricultural center areas. There's places that exist because they're a city that became because it was a military purpose, or they're just the political will. That a political oddity is why it exists,
Like St.
and the capital is one
Petersburg,
of
right?
those.
Like
Yeah,
St. Petersburg is one of those things,
something
right?
where it's like why did Venice become so important? It's not the real estate. I mean, the real
Yeah, it's
estate's sinking.
sinking, right?
Yeah, but at the time, in the historical time, it had a political reason to exist. So. As a writer, I love that kind of stuff. I love playing with that kind of stuff. Plus, I'm not a historian, so if I get stuff wrong, it doesn't matter. It's my
Yeah, it
fantasy
doesn't
world.
matter. Yeah, you make it up, right? You're the
That's how it
king.
worked out here.
Yeah. Any themes that have been recurrent throughout the series that you think are worth mentioning?
This is one that's very much talk about the collective versus the individual. And both have values at times, but like I have individuals that are forced into a place that they don't belong. And I have that kind of thing. I have themes about religion and how even bereft of religion, man will still replace religion with something else. They'll fill that void with something else. And that's actually kind of, I didn't do this on purpose 10 years ago, but I think right now we're seeing the parallels in our own world where with completely a-religious people have did the same thing as in this book series. They replaced the government with the state. And so I think that's a theme. I mean, obviously,
it doesn't matter if it doesn't make any sense. Trust the science.
Well, I mean, not that you could ever replace religion with science. I mean, come on now. But yeah, so people are going to fill that gap. They're going to leave that. They're going to fill that gap with something to believe in, and that's actually something I do get into this book quite a bit, especially because in the end, I don't want to give too much away, but I kind of show how the people that are operating, the heroes of this book, are basically like the myths and legends of the future. And I wasn't joking when I called this guy George Washington. You know what I mean? There was the man, but then there's the myth that's bigger than the man that inspires people into the future. And then obviously I'm big on good versus evil. And I will have my shades of gray. And I will have some fun with those, but ultimately, I'm the kind of guy, I like writing triumphant stuff. I like where, you know, mankind fights and struggles, but goodness wins in the end. Hope wins. I believe in hope, and I believe in heroism. This is a pretty dark fantasy series. A lot of bad. I mean, heck, we have genocide. Okay, there's literally genocide is the topic of one of these books, but I am a big believer in not having your fiction be just grim, unrelentingly grim and nihilistic. I want some hope in there. I want people to. I like heroes, and so yeah, I guess that's a theme there. I'm very big on heroism and the inspiration we get from that. So, not that I'm a theme man. I don't sit down and think what are my themes going to be. I'm just me, and I think the stuff that I the stuff that I believe in just kind of like creeps in no matter what.
In terms of, you know, this series, beyond it, what are you working on now, or what are you working on next?
I got a few things going on. I'm doing my next book that's coming out is a progression fantasy called Academy of Outcasts. That'll be out in October. That's from Athon. And that was my first foray into a different genre and a different market, because I've never done anything in KU before, so I'm experimenting there. See how that goes. Mm-hmm. It was fun, just a fun adventure fantasy.
Just experimenting.
Yeah, yeah, kind of a
diversification.
Like,
right.
I went from like super deep and dark and all basically it's like a Dungeons and Dragons level. Let's just, you know, have fun and blow stuff up. You know, one of the main characters is a shark man. I mean, that it was actually a character that I played in a D&D campaign a few years ago. And then after that, I'm doing a different urban fantasy series, but I don't really have too much information on that. I have several more Monster Hunter projects in the works and coming out from Van. I have the next memoirs book, the follow-up to Fever with Jason Cordova. And I also have another one that we've not talked about in public a whole lot yet, with Les Johnson, another memoirs book. Oh. And we're also working on the next Monster Hunter Files 2, which is the next collection of short fiction from a bunch of different authors. So I've got those three going on right now. So that's hopping. And then the rest of the mainline series is something that I'm working on. I've got some cool stuff planned for the next two. So we'll see how that goes.
Any advice for aspiring writers out there in terms of coming up with a career, starting a career in writing and kind of getting things published?
Honestly, okay. So me and Steve Diamond do a podcast called Writer Dojo, where we've talked about this. We have 150 episodes, and it is basically exactly that. It's like trying to help writers either get started in the career field or make the jump from amateur to professional. And we hit a super wide variety of topics. And so I would just say, go check that out. Scroll, it's on Spotify, anywhere that's got podcasts, just scroll through, pick out some topics that you think sound interesting to you as a as an aspiring author or someone trying to make the jump to the next level, and see if there's some stuff in there. We talk a lot of business. We talk a lot of nuts and bolts, behind the scenes stuff, and how stuff works. We're very non-fluffy. We're a very non-fluffy, non-artistic podcast.
Yeah, very good. If you need answers, just go ahead.
We try to keep it. We just try to keep it to business. But yeah, check that out. If I was to give one single piece of advice to a writer, is be prolific. And that was what Kevin J. Anderson told me when I asked him the same question, like when I first was getting started, as be prolific, because the more you do it, the more you write, the more likely you are to get good at it, and more likely you are to create something really awesome. So just keep going, keep writing, keep creating, and you will continue to get better.
All right, that was pretty much your final words to the audience, but I'll give you one last chance. Any final words for the audience?
No, that was a good one. That was a good one to end on. I'm good. And it's Super Bowl Sunday, so I'm gonna go start cooking. And we're just gonna have like a lot of chicken wings and snacks today.
Which team is your team?
I don't even have one, honestly. I haven't followed any pro football this year at all. So, though I did see the hippo at the Cincinnati Zoo pick the Eagles, and it's hard to argue with the hippo touching its snout to the glass. I mean, that's pretty scientific because let's see, zoology is a science,
I
and
agree.
so
I agree
this.
100%.
The
Trust the
science has
science.
spoken.
Yeah, trust the
I
science.
mean,
So,
Mudang the hippo picked Donald Trump over Kamala Harris. I don't know if you saw that. They brought out two watermelons. One had Trump on it, and the other had Kamala. And Mudang ate the Trump one, and he won.
hey,
I'm just saying.
Larry, I don't need to see that. I trust the science. Right, my friend, as
Why I write
always,
fantasy.
yeah, everybody go out. Buy Heart of the Mountain, buy Monster Hunter Files 1, buy all Monster Hunter books, check out Larry's new stuff that's coming out in the next year. And as always, it's a pleasure talking to you.
Now we continue the final chapter of Wen Spencer's Tinker, Part 86. Girl genius Tinker lives in a near-future Pittsburgh where she runs her salvage business, pays her taxes, and tries to keep the local ambient level of magic down with gadgets of her own design. Life as she knows it takes a serious detour, and she's faced with many distractions just as she really wants to focus on what's important, her first date.
The area affected wouldn't grow? No. The local gate doesn't have the power to affect more than a few. She considered the possible range. 100 feet? I think a mile from the gate would be the maximum range. You planned it this way? Actually, I planned for it to tear the orbital gate apart, which it should do any second now, with Pittsburgh going back to Earth permanently. He glanced to the city below and then to her.
Then you're staying with me?
Yes. This is my home. Silence fell while he was kissing her. Being in his arms, knowing that they had forever together, made the pain bearable. Still, she didn't want to turn and see the city gone, so she kept her eyes closed tight and thought of only how much she loved him. The kissing led to other things, and he eased her back onto the tarps and, careful of her cuts and bruises, made gentle love to her. Sometime later, he grew still and silent.
Love, I do not think it worked.
Hmm? She rolled over to follow his gaze. Pittsburgh was still there. Shit! She rolled on her back to look at the stars instead. Aw, damn. What could have gone wrong?
Perhaps your gate failed first.
Oh, I was so sure it wouldn't. It didn't on any of the model programs I ran.
It is no matter. We will settle it with politics.
Tinker made a rude noise. The governments of Earth are not going to want to destroy it. It represents too much money.
We can compromise. If they destroy the orbital gate, we'll fund land-based gates to replace it.
It sounded like a long, drawn-out mess with the Oni interfering at every step. A streak of light caught Tinker's eye. A falling star, she pointed out. Humans think they grant wishes. Windwolf shook his head.
I will never understand why a race without magic
can believe that so many random things are magical.
Wishful thinking.
What do you wish for?
That we can get rid of the orbital gate without triggering a war between dimensions?
A wise wish. There is another falling star.
Tinker blinked at the night sky. Is it my imagination, or is that one much larger than the first?
Look, Windwolf said and pointed to a fireball. And there, too.
For us to see anything falling, though, there must have been an explosion that kicked large parts of the orbital gate into the atmosphere. I'm surprised they didn't just bounce off.
Bounce off what?
It's, all orbital mechanics and velocities. Tinker waved it aside. Oh, that's not good. We shouldn't be able to see the gate. If that is the gate, it's in orbit around Earth. Oh, shit. I think I might have yanked it into elf home space by accident.
If it is broken, then it is off, Windwolf said. Shut down. Right?
Tinker eyed the city lights spread out down over the hills to the rivers. Oh, this is really not good. I think Pittsburgh is permanently on elf home. I'll have to run some models, but I think I changed a constant by shoving too hard, or maybe it was a resonance between the two gates.
Without the gate in orbit, we will not be able to return Pittsburgh to Earth,
Windwolf pointed out. Oh, this is so bad.
I thought you wanted to stay.
Yes, me, but the city? Without the supplies from Earth, Pittsburgh will be starving within weeks.
Ah, yes. Not to worry, love. We will work it out.
This book is over, but the story continues. Keep listening after the credits to hear the beginning of Wolf Who Rules, book number 2 in the Elf Home series, Free.
This has been the Bane Free Radio Hour. Thanks for joining us at the heart of science fiction. Join us next week on the Bane Free Radio Hour when Jeremy Comeau interviews Larry Correa once again, this time alongside editor-author Yakub Merrick regarding the Monster Hunter International anthology, Monster Hunter Phantom. Score by Ruth Judkowitz.